Accountants prepared to help clients navigate the newest tax laws, providing a full scope of small business services, tax planning, and preparation for all 50 states. A&O welcomes Spanish-speaking clients. Call 657-7716.
Support comes from Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar, Williams Bay's Coffee House, offering fresh organic coffee and espresso drinks, affordable wines and beer, live music, and delicious dishes. Located next to Dip in the Bay in Williams Bay, visit BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Mandolin Coffee. Wake up and warm up with fresh brewed creations from Mandolin Coffee. Assorted roasts are brewed to order. The market is open Saturdays at the Roney Center for the Arts from 10 until 2. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
Welcome to Community Matters. I am Troy McDonald. Today is Saturday, February 18th, 2017. Thanks for joining us this morning. OCD is a crippling disease. Known as obsessive-compulsive disorder, over 2 million Americans suffer from OCD. You might be surprised to learn that amazing and innovative research to combat OCD is happening right here in Wisconsin. You won't believe this. Please welcome Dr. Brad Riemann, Clinical Director of the OCD Center and CBT Services at Rogers Memorial Hospital. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, hello, Troy. How are you?
So let's explain, what exactly is OCD?
Sure. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is an anxiety-based condition characterized by obsessions and compulsions. Obsessions are unwanted thoughts, images, or urges that generate high levels of anxiety. So some common examples of obsessional thoughts would be the fear of becoming dirty or contaminated, doubting whether you did something or did something correctly. Did I lock the door? Did I turn off the light? Did I unplug the curling iron? The need for exactness and symmetry, things having to be just so, things having to be in their correct place. And there can be many, many other kinds of examples. Compulsions, on the other hand, are some sort of repetitive act. It can be a behavioral act, something that we could see or observe, or it can be another thought, something that, of course, we can't observe. And these compulsions, sometimes also known as rituals, are really done to combat that unwanted obsessional thought. They're done to neutralize that unwanted thought, get rid of the anxiety that is caused by that unwanted thought, or somehow to prevent some sort of bad event from occurring. So examples, in response to contamination obsessions, you get washing and cleaning compulsions. This could be washing and cleaning of themselves. It could be washing and cleaning of their surroundings. In response to the doubt, doubting whether you did something correctly. Of course, we get checking compulsions. So checking to make sure that that door is locked over and over and over again, checking to make sure that that light switch has been turned off or that curling iron is unplugged. In response to that need for exactness and symmetry, you get ordering and arranging compulsions. So people making sure things are right where they need to be, making sure that, that you know, the magazines on the coffee table are exactly in place and so on. So again, it's kind of a two-part problem, obsessions and compulsions.
From my understanding, those are quite common. You know, in fact, it's part of our popular vernacular. I am obsessed with this. I'm obsessed with that. When does that become dangerous?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's kind of two things that come to mind. I mean, one, you know, lay people and the media many times use obsessed, you know, in a different direction than in psychiatry we would. So in other words, he's obsessed with video games. She's obsessed with her ex-boyfriend. Again, remember, obsessional thought is an unwanted thought, something that someone doesn't want to have. It creates lots of anxiety. If you ask, you know, a young guy who plays way too many video games, do you like thinking about video games? Oh, yeah. Do you like playing video games? Yes, and I wish I could play more. If you ask somebody with OCD, do you like thinking about becoming contaminated? No. Do you like washing your hands until they crack and bleed? No. Mm. And what can I do to stop? So, you know, the lay definition and sometimes the media definition of obsessed is really quite different. you know, than in psychiatry. Now, specifically, however, your question is, you know, I think also a good one in the sense that sometimes people say, well, you know, I do some of that. You know, I find myself going back and making sure that, you know, the light's off every once in a while. And some people do look at obsessive compulsive disorder as really kind of a great exaggeration of the norm. Yes, everybody has washed their hands from time to time because they just kind of quote unquote felt dirty. You know, they didn't look dirty, but they just kind of felt dirty. Everybody's gone back and checked to make sure they locked their car door or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And so some people look at this as a great exaggeration of norm, but I want to emphasize the word great. I mean, there's a gap between this kind of normal behavior and when someone has obsessive compulsive disorder. And the distinction is that someone is doing these things so much that it creates disorder or interference in their life, either occupationally, academically, socially, or in their family relationships. It creates interference in their life, that it creates impairment, and that's when we say they have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people think of this, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is kind of like that mommy dearest from the famous movie from the 80s, you know, that kind of thing. Can these people be regularly normal, or is there something that is off? Can you tell when someone has this?
For the most part, no. I mean, in other words, what we would find, you know, in most people who would have the diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder, they do a great job of hiding this. They do understand or have insight that what they're doing is not typical or not normal. They fear embarrassment. So they, you know, we'll get phone calls from people who say, you know, I wash my hands 100 times a day. My husband has no idea. And so they can really get quite good at hiding it. We'll have a youngster in school who has obsessive compulsive disorder. We'll get, you know, permission to speak to the young man's teacher, and the teacher will say, I have had him in class for 9 months. I've never seen him do that once. That doesn't mean that Johnny doesn't have this great desire and great anxiety about, you know, the OCD issue, but he's not going to embarrass himself in front of his friends. And then, unfortunately, he kind of goes home and, you know, really kind of makes up for it, so to speak. So they do have insight. They do try to shroud it or hide it because they fear embarrassment. And for the most part, what we find is these people, you know, they're good neighbors to have, they're good friends to have, they're good, you know, siblings or whatever. It's just this one area of their life that is turned upside down. Now, obviously, OCD can also get very, very severe. And in those cases, you know, unfortunately, people are going to have a much harder time hiding it, so to speak. And it can get to the point where, of course, life basically stops. And in that case, you know, there's more than just one area of their life that's turned upside down.
And you kind of mentioned this in your answer, but children can get this. This is not something that adults get. This starts in children. It can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, it is not uncommon for it to develop in childhood. There almost seems to be kind of two at-risk ages, if you will. There's a subset of individuals with OCD that, you know, will develop it somewhere around the age of 10, and then there's another subset that seems to develop it around the age of 20, you know, with, of course, lots of variability in between. But absolutely, it can occur in children. Somewhere between probably, you know, 1 to maybe 2% of children have OCD.
Wow. Why do you think that is? What causes this? I mean, is this genetic? Does it pass down from, you know, generation to generation, or can it just pop up magically, I guess?
Well, both. You know, first and foremost, Troy, unfortunately, nobody knows what causes OCD. So we don't know. There's lots of different theories out there. I think the theories that probably hold the most water at this point, you know, is that there is probably some sort of neurobiological abnormality that is going on. Is it structural? Is it, you know, chemical? We really don't know. Genetics does seem to influence this condition, so that whatever that neurobiological abnormality is that we suspect appears to be genetically influenced. Why do we say that? OCD does tend to run in families. And, you know, just because something runs in families doesn't mean it's genetic. It could be learned. But there's been some really fascinating studies that have really, you know, teased that apart. And it does appear to be more of a genetic influence than a learning kind of thing. There's been adoption studies that have looked at individuals who were adopted. Their biological parents, say, were positive for OCD. They're adopted into a family that is negative for OCD. They're more likely to develop it. The reverse is true. If you your biological parents are clean for OCD and you're adopted into a family that's positive for OCD, you're not very likely to develop it. So it does appear to be genetically influenced.
Is there a certain subset of people that are more susceptible to getting OCD, or can it happen to anyone?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I think back to the point we were just making that, you know, obviously it appears that if you have a family history of this, you're more likely to develop it. You're more at risk to develop it. Now, one question that, you know, adults will commonly ask us will say, you know, someone who has OCD will say the last thing in the world I ever want to do is to have a child and pass this misery along to them. Should I have children? You know, we're talking about an increased risk. But, you know, if you're planning on having a child, the odds are against the fact that genetically you're going to give them OCD. They're at increased risk, however. They may be 6 to 7 times more likely to get it than, say, the general public, but the odds are still against them getting it. In terms of, like, you know, can anyone just get it? I mean, this isn't like an infection, it doesn't appear. It's not like, you know, if you're just kind of wandering through your life and suddenly you develop OCD or something triggers it. I mean, the way I try to describe it to people is chances are, and again, we don't know what causes OCD, but chances are, you know, there's a biological seed that you have either through genetics or through kind of the random roll of the biological dice. You have this biological seed, and then chances are environmental factors do influence it. So, you know, we talk about kind of the, you know, an environmental match striking the biological gasoline on fire. And you kind of have to have both. But it appears that, you know, the matchbox for environmental matches is pretty big. I mean, there's all sorts of things, and they don't have to be cataclysmic, you know, to really strike this biological gas on fire. So, for example, I mentioned earlier that, you know, around the age of 20 is another kind of high-risk age, if you will. What happens around 20 is generally an increase in responsibility in people's lives. They go off to college, they move out, they get a job, maybe they get married, maybe they have a baby, you know, all of these kinds of real-life stressors. And those are the kinds of things that seem to, you know, be able to ignite this biological gas on fire. In my opinion, if you don't have the biological gas, you know, those environmental matches are not going to cause OCD. If you have the biological gas, I guess then the question is, can you dodge the environmental matches? And at this point, I don't think so. So someone might say, well, you know, gee, Dr. Riemann, you had mentioned that, you know, me going off to school and getting my own apartment, and that's when I started checking to see if the stove was turned off over and over and over again, because I was afraid that I might forget to turn the stove off and burn the apartment building down and you know, harm those other people that are in there. So you're telling me if I'd never gone to college, I wouldn't have had OCD? No, chances are, again, that box of matches is pretty big. Chances are, even if you hadn't gone to college, there would have been something. You know, for example, you might have moved out to get into an apartment anyway. You might have lived in the same apartment building, but instead of going to college, you just got a job. So it may be a situation, if you have that biological seed, you can run, but you can't hide.
We talk about kind of the checking and kind of the cleanliness. What are some other ways that OCD can show itself? Because that's kind of like a generalization that we see in the media, that these people who have this are just, they clean all the time, they're checking. Are there other ways that people can have OCD?
Oh, yeah. You know, so again, those obsessional thoughts, we mentioned, you know, kind of some of the classic hallmark ones, but it can really manifest itself in other ways. So other kinds of symptoms, people can have religious obsessions. Atheists don't have religious obsessions. These are the most pious kind of, you know, faithful people. These are the same people that go to church every week, sit in the same pew every week, and so on. And suddenly start to get hit with these very kind of sacrilegious thoughts. And, you know, kind of getting back to, you know, the great exaggeration of the norm thing we were talking about. My guess is if we were interviewing people leaving church, say we interview 100 people leaving church, and we say, you know, have you ever had, you know, a really bad sacrilegious thought while you were sitting in church? Have you ever really, you know, if you had a thought like Jesus is really the devil, or, you know, these kinds of things, have you ever had things like that cross your mind? If people were being honest, I think the vast, vast, vast majority of people would say, you know, yeah, I have. And then if we said, well, what do you do with those thoughts? And they say, well, you know, I just kind of go, well, that's kind of a strange thought, and I just kind of discarded it and went back to listening to the sermon. Yeah, right. Okay, good. However, we're going to find, say, 2.5%, because that's the lifetime prevalence of OCD in the United States. We're going to find 2.5% of the people who may say, yes, and I get those thoughts all the time. In fact, I get them so often, I'm considering not coming to church anymore because I'm just really worried about having these thoughts. But when you get those thoughts, what do you try to do with them? Do you just try to get rid of them? Well, yeah. I mean, I don't just kind of discard them and ignore them and go back to the sermon. I say to myself, don't ever, ever, ever think of that thought again. Well, what do we know, Troy, about the human mind? You know, what happens when we try not to think of something? I mean,
we think about it.
Exactly. And the more we try to push it out of our mind, the more we think about it. So it really kind of has this, you know, opposite effect. I mean, in the OCD world, we call this thought suppression. They're trying to suppress their thought. They're trying to push it out of their mind. And it's like a spring. The harder they push against it, boom, the more it comes back. And this thought suppression may be, you know, an issue. This may be kind of a reason why people have OCD. But so religious thoughts are a very common example, or sometimes it's referred to in the literature as scrupulosity, someone with this kind of hyper-religiosity, hyper-moralism. Hmm. Sexual thoughts can also be another kind of obsession. Now, again, we want to go back to our definition. These are unwanted thoughts, images, or impulses that generate high levels of anxiety. These individuals are not a risk to anyone. These are not the thoughts that a pedophile has. You know, if you're interviewing someone who, you know, is a pedophile, do you like thinking about children? They're going to say, I know I shouldn't, but yes, I do. And so they may have thoughts that, and they may not always be necessarily in the pedophile way, but they're going to be these unwanted sexual thoughts, these unacceptable to them sexual thoughts that, again, they try to push out of their mind. Harming obsessions are also another fairly common obsession, and again, perfect example of the unwantedness. These are pretty common in people with newborn children, so they bring their baby home from the hospital, and they're sitting there thinking how beautiful and tiny and innocent they are, and suddenly they get hit with this thought that, geez, I could just snap my child's neck. You know, where did that come from, right? There's been studies done that show that like 93% of people with newborn children report having these thoughts. Thankfully, the vast majority of people just kind of look at the thought and go, well, that was kind of weird, and throw it away and go back to loving their child. Someone who, in my opinion, is biologically predisposed to having OCD can't do that. They go, whoa, where did that come from? Why did I have that thought? I'm not that kind of a person. Well, then why did I have that thought? Maybe I am that kind of a person. And again, the end result is I don't know why I had it, but I can tell you one thing. I'm never, ever, ever, ever going to have it again. And they try to suppress it, and of course it returns. So those are just some other examples of obsessional thoughts. In terms of compulsions, you know, we talked about washing, cleaning, checking, ordering, and arranging. Sometimes people will have to count objects in the room over and over again, the proverbial ceiling tiles. They may have to count to some sort of kind of magic number that for some reason they feel kind of neutralizes that bad thought. They may have to repeat certain words or thoughts or phrases silent in their own mind. They may have to repeat them out loud. They may have to repeat certain behaviors like retracing their steps. So it could be many, many, many things.
I'm guessing that once you get to this point, you know, it's obvious to seek help. Do patients who eventually do get diagnosed with OCD, do they want the help? Because what you're saying is they're suppressing it, they're trying to keep it internal, they're embarrassed, they're ashamed. How do they go and get help? Is that a process?
Well, it is a process. You know, unfortunately, there's you know, multiple different factors that, you know, kind of interfere with this process. I mean, one is that people who, you know, are embarrassed by these thoughts, we had mentioned before, may hide it from their spouse and that kind of thing. They may even hide it from their mental health provider. I mean, we've had people call us and say, "Yeah, gee, Dr. Reiman, this is Dr. Smith. I wanted to talk to you about a potential patient. This person came in, you know, last night and told me they had OCD. Well, how long have you been seeing them, Dr. Smith? I've been seeing them for 8 years. What were you seeing them for? Well, they said it was depression. And so here's a person who, you know, had OCD for all that time and just didn't even feel comfortable telling their mental health provider. We've even had people come to Rogers, you know, the OCD Center at Rogers. The name is on the sign, so to speak. And there might be certain symptoms that they're reluctant to tell us. We've just mentioned the harming obsessions with children. Many times people are just terrified that we're going to take their children away from them, even though they are at no risk of hurting their children. They're the last people on the planet who would ever hurt anybody. Again, these are not the thoughts that people have when they go commit a heinous crime. These are not the thoughts that people have when they walk into a marketplace and pull the ripcord on an explosive vest and kill people. Those are not unwanted thoughts. Those are, unfortunately, wanted thoughts. And so these people are not, you know, at risk to hurt anyone. But so part of the process, or an obstacle to the process, is they may be reluctant to tell a mental health care provider. The other obstacle is there are very, very few centers of excellence in terms of treatment. So we kind of hopefully have kind of described that OCD is a very common problem, a very debilitating problem, but it's also a very, very treatable problem when treated properly. And proper treatment consists of a certain kind of treatment known as exposure and ritual prevention, and then also the dosage, the amount of treatment. The more severe and complicated the OCD, the more exposure and ritual prevention someone needs. I'll also take a moment now to talk a little bit about medication. There are medications that have been found to be helpful in treating OCD. They produce about 25 to 30% symptom reduction, which is great because there's many, many medicines that don't provide any relief for OCD. So there are some medicines that are helpful. That 25 to 30% symptom reduction could be the difference between being able to go to school and not, or being able to go to school and going to school and functioning in school or something like that. So by no means should that be interpreted as a black eye. But the treatment of choice for OCD, if you were only going to do medicine or exposure and ritual prevention, you'd actually choose the ERP, exposure and ritual prevention.
Right, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I do want to reintroduce the program. You are listening to Community Matters on WGTD. I'm Troy McDonald. Today, we are talking about an often misunderstood disease, OCD, and the remarkable work Rogers Hospital here in Wisconsin is doing to help those suffering. My guest is spearheading innovative research at Rogers. He is Dr. Brad Reiman, Clinical Director OCD at the OCD Center and CBT Services at Rogers Memorial Hospital. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you, Troy. It's been a good conversation thus far, and as we were saying, that another obstacle to treatment is the lack of availability. I mean, in other words, we were talking about how you know, medicines are helpful. The vast majority of people with OCD have access to medicine, thankfully, again, because of that first problem, the fear of embarrassment or whatever it might be, they may not access that, sadly, but most of them have access to it. And if they follow their doctor's orders, again, on average, they could expect 25 to 30% symptom relief, which could be a difference maker. But it also means, sadly, that they have 70 to 75% of quite a bit of a problem left. And that's where we were talking about ERP, or exposure and ritual prevention, which, as we mentioned, is the treatment of choice. But there are very few centers of excellence. There's very few places around the country that provide that kind of treatment and provide it in an adequate enough dose for some people. So again, there's, I think there was a study done a few years ago that the average person with OCD, you know, has OCD for an average of about 8 years before they even get properly diagnosed.
Wow. How much damage could be done within that time period? Can you reverse some of those? Obviously, the reduction with the medication, but once you're suffering for 8 years, doesn't it kind of become a habit at that point?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, what I would say is certainly, you know, is there a lot of damage that occurs? Yes. I mean, in other words, there's a tremendous amount of suffering and pain that occurs in those 8 years, which nobody can erase. But the good news is, you know, duration of illness has no impact on treatment outcomes. So when we're looking at exposure and ritual prevention, you know, whether you've had it 8 months, 8 years, 30 years, your outcome is not going to be impacted by that. And in fact, what I can tell you is sometimes when someone has had it so long, they're more motivated to kind of do what they need to do to get rid of it. We had a woman, this is probably 10 years ago or so now, she was about 80 years old, and she came in and she had OCD, and I, you know, we asked her, well, how long have you had it? And she was kind of that typical adult onset that had occurred around the age of 20. So she said, well, I've had this about 60 years, and it's time to get rid of it. And believe it or not, she came in, she did what we needed her to do, and she got better.
Wow.
You know, so you know, unfortunately, again, it doesn't erase the suffering. It doesn't erase the fact that, you know, so-and-so never went to their high school prom because of their OCD. You can't erase the fact that, despite being smart, you know, so-and-so didn't do well in high school or couldn't finish college, or, you know, I mean, now it's possible through treatment maybe they could go back and finish college, but you can't erase the past.
Right. And so we've been talking about, you know, medication and the reduction there, but Rogers practices and encourages CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy, which I'm thinking ties into the exposure that we're mentioning. So if you could talk about CBT and why that is Rogers' preferred method of treatment.
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy is really kind of a much broader spectrum, and exposure and ritual prevention is just a specific technique out of that kind of school of thought. So you can kind of think of it as like a restaurant menu. There's all sorts of different items on a restaurant menu. There's all sorts of different interventions on the CBT menu, and exposure and ritual prevention is one that we would take out if we were treating someone with OCD. This is not anything that we, you know, have developed ourselves. There's certainly, this is something that's been around since the 60s, believe it or not, and it's been studied and studied and studied, and there's basically an enormous room full of data that has been collected on its effectiveness. It is the most effective treatment we have by far. This is because of two reasons. One, it produces the highest rates of outcomes. Success rates are anywhere, depending on which study you look at, 75 to 85%.
Wow.
And very low relapse rates, which is, of course, key. So this was something that I had the benefit of being trained in by kind of one of the thought leaders when I was in graduate school. The first case that I had in graduate school to treat, you know, this was this woman that, again, you know, in many ways you would have never known had this problem, but in this one area her life had been turned upside down. And, you know, I went in there, and despite the fact that I was very green, you know, I applied what I had been taught, and guess what? She got better. And at that moment I was hooked. I mean, when I saw the relief of pain that we could provide with this treatment, you know, I was instantaneously hooked. And I thought, if I can master this treatment, you know, here I am, this green graduate student, and look what I did. If I can master this treatment, you know, think of all the good that I can do. And exposure and ritual prevention, if you remember, OCD has two parts. There's obsessions and compulsions. So the treatment has to have two parts, exposure and ritual prevention. So exposure targets the obsessional thoughts. Ritual prevention, of course, targets the compulsions or the rituals. So an example, you know, we talked about contamination and so forth. And And people who are afraid of dirt and germs will commonly say there are certain things that they just can't do. I can't shake people's hands. I can't touch doorknobs. Well, why can't you touch doorknobs? Well, I just don't know who used them last, and maybe they were sick, and now maybe I'll get sick, you know, these kinds of things. So from an exposure and ritual prevention standpoint, let's just take doorknobs. You know, we would say, well, you know, how anxious would you be if we actually had you touch a doorknob exposure and not wash it off before or not wash your hands off after? That's ritual prevention. And, of course, different patients are going to give you a different rating. And say we have them rate this on a 0 to 7 scale, 0 being no anxiety at all, 7 being the most anxious they could ever possibly imagine being. You know, one patient that I see on Monday may say 3, another patient may say 7, another one may say 0. There's no two patients that are alike. But most of them are going to say, well, it kind of depends. And you'll say, well, it depends on what? Well, it depends on what doorknob you're going to ask me to touch. If it's the doorknob in my bedroom, that's not nearly as bad. Is my brother's doorknob? Well, why is your brother's doorknob into his bedroom worse than yours? Well, he's only 5 years old. He's always dirty, and he's always sneezing, and he's always kind of gross. So I think his doorknob is dirtier. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. So let's start with your doorknob. On a scale of 0 to 7, how difficult would it be for you if we asked you to touch your bedroom doorknob and don't wash it off before and don't wash you after? 2. What about your brother's bedroom doorknob? 4. How about the bathroom doorknob down the hall? Oh, that would be much harder. 7. Moral of the story is, that's an example of an exposure and ritual prevention exercise. You'd have someone touch these doorknobs, exposure, not wash their hands, ritual prevention, and you do it in a very, very structured and systematic way. So we would develop, in many cases, dozens and dozens, if not 100 or more, individually generated exposure exercises, individually tailored to this person's needs. And of course, we then do them in what we call a graduated fashion. So in my example, there was like a 2, I think, and a 4 and a 7. We don't start with 7s, right? I mean, that most people are not going to be able to tolerate that. And most people aren't going to be willing to push themselves into the exposure. Most people aren't going to be willing to touch that doorknob. And then even those that could, how many of them won't go home and wash their hands, right? Because that's the second part of treatment. We not only have to have them touching these things, they can't be washing their hands, or they literally wash away the treatment. So we don't start with 7s. We usually just start right below the midpoint. So on that 0 to 7 scale, we start people off in their 3s. That's kind of the sweet spot. That's where we're going to get the most compliance. That's where we're going to get people being able to do the exposures and manage the ritual prevention piece. And again, if someone does this in a very structured and systematic fashion, it produces tremendous outcomes for OCD. Sadly, there are very few places that provide this kind of treatment. Rogers provides intensive outpatient, day treatment, and residential services for very, very disabled cases. People come from literally all over the world for our residential programs. There are very, very few places like that. And believe it or not, on any given day, we have about 275 people with OCD being treated in our system, anywhere from the age of 6 to, I mentioned the woman, up to 80, I guess. That's not common, obviously, in a variety of levels of care. And we're literally the world's largest OCD treatment provider.
Wow. And speaking of that, you're taking all of your experience and transferring it into this new study, and you're finding ways to use mobile apps to curb some of the effects of OCD. So explain, of course, how you landed on smartphone apps and why this particular treatment.
Yeah, sure. So this kind of goes back to research that I was involved with in graduate school many years ago. So I got to kind of lay a little bit of the groundwork. So people with OCD have been found to kind of have their radar out, so to speak, for things that trigger their concerns. So again, we're going to use contamination as an example. So say someone has contamination OCD, So again, they're afraid they're going to become dirty or ill. And so when they're walking through their day-to-day life, they're basically scanning their environment for any little signs of dirt or germs. Things that you and I could be walking right next to them. It's happening in our world too, but because we don't have our radar out, we just don't detect it. So for example, say you and I and someone with OCD is sitting around a conference table having a meeting, and let's just say I kind of put my hand in my mouth and quickly and cough like that. Your radar is not out. You don't even detect that. The person with contamination absolutely heard it, saw it, registered it. And, of course, their thought is, this meeting is going to be over probably in about 10 minutes. What if I have to shake his hand? Then maybe I'm going to get sick. So they have their radar out for this. And this is what people would tell us. In graduate school, we developed a computer program to really kind of objectively measure this, what we called attention bias. So they have this bias in their attention. Their attention is not being doled out like ours is. It's not being evenly distributed throughout their environment like ours is. Their radar is out for specific kind of threat cues, if you will, contamination cues. And we developed this program that measured this. And it was a very, very unique and important series of studies that we did. What we found is that if you had someone go through cognitive behavior therapy, this exposure and ritual prevention we've been talking about, if you tested them on this computer, they showed this bias. If you put them through ERP and then tested them again, the bias went away. So we knew that ERP was shutting this radar off. But what we've been trying to do ever since, and this is 20 years in the making, what we've been doing ever since is, could we create something that targeted that bias directly? In other words, we believe that that's kind of the key here. And we know CBT does it, which is great. We know it's effective, which is great. But the problem is, again, very few people have access to the treatment, right? There's just very few centers of excellence. So if we could come up with a way to target that bias, shut that bias down, maybe we could get, you know, gain access to treatment for way more people who are suffering from OCD. So that's been kind of the goal. So the program that we've tested on desktops and laptops, so just regular size computer monitors, we kind of tweaked that assessment tool that we developed 20 years ago in graduate school, and we created a treatment out of it. We've created what we call attention retraining, and this attention retraining basically shuts that radar down. It trains people to steer their attention away from the threat, you know, and more evenly distribute it like we do. We've got 12 published studies, and what that means in my world, a published study is something, you know, that it's a study that's conducted, you know, in the most rigorous fashion. We then send it to a journal. This journal sends it out to experts in the field. It gets vetted. It gets chewed up and spit out and torn apart. And you know, it's a very rigorous process. And then hopefully, you know, it gets published. We have about a dozen published studies supporting attention retraining for OCD and other anxiety disorders on desktops and laptops. And in my world, if you have two studies in support of what you're doing, it's called empirically supported. In other words, that means research says there's something to this. Well, we have 12. So then we get six times as many as you really kind of need. Now, what we're trying to do, though, is shrink it. So the study that we're currently conducting at Rogers is on an app. So we're taking what we have found to be effective on a normal-sized desktop, and we're shrinking it down into an app version. Now, it's possible that by shrinking it, we may lose the effect. Maybe the size of the presentation does have an impact. So we can't just conclude because the desktop ones work that the handheld app is going to work, right? We got to retest it. So shrinking it could lose the effect. On the other hand, you know, we believe it won't. And if by shrinking it, and we still find it to be effective, Everybody's got smartphones these days. Everybody's got access to this stuff. And in a way, you got access to it almost 24/7. And so that's the study that we're doing. We're doing two studies at Rogers. One is a community-based study where we're seeking people with OCD from the community to come in and test this app in our labs. We have a lab in Oconomowoc at our Oconomowoc location and also Brown Deer location. We're also doing a treatment enhancement study at Rogers. So people seeking treatment at Rogers, either get treatment as usual plus kind of this placebo app, this app that doesn't have the key ingredient in it, or treatment as usual plus the active version. And we're hoping to show that it has an enhancement of treatment that, you know, of course, everyone's going to get better, but the people that get the app plus treatment will get better still. Back to the community study.
Yeah, and we have about 3 minutes left, so I kind of want to touch on what have you found thus far?
Well, we're just kind of getting started, but the early returns look good. The early returns on the app look promising, that people using it seem to be getting better. The individuals, the participation is actually fairly user-friendly. They only need to come in 9 times, twice a week for 4 weeks is the actual active study. One early visit is for the assessment to make sure that they're qualified for the study. So it takes twice a week for 4 weeks, probably about a half an hour at a time, and we do reimburse people. So we pay them $250 if they complete the study. So we value their time. We understand that they're giving us that time, so we reimburse them for their participation. And again, it's really only a twice a week for 4 week commitment.
Wow. And these are 18 to, I'm guessing, up.
65 is what our age cutoff is, but even if you're a little bit older than that, please give us a call, because we still might consider you.
Right. So how can people who are listening to this who might be suffering from OCD,
yep,
or know someone that they love that has it, how can they get a hold of this and be a part of this,
yep,
innovative study?
Yeah, great. Thank you. So the phone number to call is 414-865-2600. And I'll repeat that. It's 414-865-2600. We also have a research page and our website. It's researchstudies@rogershospital.org. Again, that's researchstudies@rogershospital.org. So they could connect through the webpage. There's an information part that they can fill out that will connect us with them, or they could simply call our laboratory.
Thank you so much, Dr. Riemann, for being here. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your time.
That was Dr. Brad Riemann, the clinical director of the OCD Center and CBT services at Rogers Memorial Hospital. Again, for more information, check out their website, because this really affects so many people. They had 275 patients who are currently seeking treatment. They're some of the best in the world. So if you know someone who needs the services, reach out to their OCD Center. Thank you for listening today on Community Matters. I'm Troy McDonald for WGTD. Classical music on Wisconsin Public Radio is next.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org, click Talk, and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Support comes from Andrea and Orendorf, certified public accountants, welcoming new small business and individual clients, providing a full scope of small business services, tax planning, and preparation for every type of business and personal entity. A&O welcomes Spanish-speaking clients. Visit AOCPA.net. Support comes from the Racine Theater Guild, presenting Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, a heartfelt comedy with wit and absurdity, winner of the 2013 Tony Award for Best Play, on stage weekends through January 28th. For performance times and tickets, visit racinetheater.org.
Support comes from Jack Andreas. Enjoy up to 75% off select merchandise and floor fixtures while we ready ourselves for our 2018 Reimagining Remodel. We'll be temporarily closed starting Sunday, January 28th. Visit jackandrea.com for details and scheduled pop-up shops around town.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Racine Heritage Museum invites you to A Night at the Speakeasy, a fundraiser